Zach Lowe joins me to talk about watering plants, the Detroit Pistons, giant werewolves, and our NBA-related fears. All of that's coming up and more right now on this episode of Divine Intervention. And I quote, "I can't live my life worried about what people might say about me. I won't let that stop me from trying new things and doing things I want to do. Some people might not like that, but a sure failure is if you stop trying," end quote. That is what Flavor Flav tweeted on Sunday after he sang the national anthem at Bucks Hawks, and I hope it inspires you as much as it inspires me. John Gennaro, count me in! The first words belong to the man who gave us 911 as a joke, but the rest of them belong to me. Welcome to episode 2 of Divine Intervention, a self-help podcast about basketball. My name is Dan Devine, and before we get rolling, here are three things that I am grateful for today. One, I get paid by Yahoo Sports to speak about the NBA on camera and into this microphone. Two, those little glass watering globes for houseplants. The ones where you can like fill them up with water, stick them in the soil, and then that way there's water whenever the plant's thirsty. I used to be a plant serial killer, and now we're doing a little bit better in our house with those. So it's a nice thing for me. And number three, even more than that, I get to have a chat with a real up-and-comer in this business. You know, someone I think you're going to be hearing a lot from in the years ahead. Joining me today, a blog-era compatriot whose work I have cherished for more than 15 years. Man, we're getting old. I know. I shouldn't have said that part. He is a veteran of Sports Illustrated and Grantland.com and someone with whom I have had on occasion one beer. Okay, maybe more than one, but never directly after the trade deadline, which saddens me. He is a senior writer for ESPN.com. He's a regular contributor to NBA Today and NBA Countdown, and he is the host of the wildly successful podcast, The Low Post. Friends, a warm welcome for Zach Lowe. Zach, thank you so much for doing this. How are you doing today, brother?
I'm better now. That was fantastic, and I'm going to take the... I'm going to take the plant tip to the better half because she identifies as a plant serial killer. I am just out on the whole plant care process. In fact, I am an overwaterer. When it's my job to water the plants, I kill them by overwatering. So I'm good. This is all important information for me already.
This is exactly right, because I'm the same way. I would think like, well, when in doubt, water more. And then as it turns out, no good. And so this is like, it takes the control aspect out of your hands. And I'm just looking for that in all aspects of my life. Can I rescind control in more aspects of it and then have things actually grow and prosper? So I think it's a good tip to bring. And I'm glad that I could start today by sharing that with you.
I haven't bothered to research, like just do one Google search on why and how water, like too much water can be bad. I haven't done that one yet. To me, it's like the plant should just be happy it's getting a little extra to drink. I don't get it. I don't get what's happening.
Well, here on Divine Intervention, we're happy to have a little bit extra of you today. And with Halloween upon us, we are recording on Monday, the day before Halloween, we're going to be talking today about fears. Things in the NBA that, you know, scare us or maybe should scare some teams this season. Some things to be a little bit scared about. But first, even when things are scary here on Divine Intervention, we operate from a place of joy. So, Zach, as our guest this week, I'm going to ask you, what is something from the world of basketball that's brought you joy in this first almost week of the NBA season?
So I could go with the low hanging fruit. Talk about Victor Wembanyama and how exciting it is to finally watch him. I could go with the slightly higher low-hanging fruit of Chet Holmgren. I had great Chet Holmgren's round Thunder or Frisky. I could make a joke about the Bulls and the players-only meeting. But I'm not going to do that, Dan Devine. This is too important of a podcast appearance. I'm going to go a little deeper for you. And I have two words that everyone needs to start getting ready to know right now in the NBA if they haven't been paying attention yet. And the words are Jalen Duren. And the Detroit Pistons, who are 2-1. Now, it's not going to last. I don't think the Pistons are going to be a playoff team all of a sudden. But holy smokes, Jalen Duren, through three games, 18 points, 15 rebounds. That leads the NBA. 80% shooting because he has 18 dunks in three games, which is number one in the league by six whole dunks. Six dunks in three games over number two, which is Evan Mobley. He leads the league in offensive rebounding rate. He's also sneakily averaging 4 assists a game. He's got a little more skill than you might think when you read all these dunk and rim running numbers. And look, there's a lot to sort out in Detroit. Asar Thompson is pretty raw offensively, but he's a beast defensively. Jaden Ivey is like
everywhere, man.
Jaden Ivey's like somehow coming off the bench. So like the Jaden Ivey like thunder and lightning thing is kind of not happening. But Cade looks good and Duren looks good. And the Pistons, you know, we'll see the degree to which they have a roadmap anywhere. But Jalen Duren has been like must watch NBA nerd television through three games. The guy is just jumping all over the place and getting every rebound and dunking the hell out of every ball. It's been really fun to watch. Jalen Duren has brought me joy.
I love that. I love it for two reasons. One, we like to think about players sometimes in terms of their arc, their development. And it's like, this is a continuation of really strong rookie season for him, goes and plays on the select team with Cade, is drawing rave reviews in the summertime, and then carries that into the season. It's nice to see when the tick, 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 tick goes up. Also nice because one of the big things everybody had wondered about heading into the season with Detroit was like, all right, they've got 50-11 centers, and what are they going to do with all of them? A really elegant way to solve that problem is one guy just plays really well and sort of establishes himself over the top of the rest of them. Less good if you're, you know, a James Wiseman stockholder at this point, which, you know, you've had some diamond hands for a while and you've hurt yourself in that situation if you are one of those stockholders. But, you know, he's not figuring into the rotation right now. Marvin Bagley, 15 minutes a game. The reason is Jalen Duren has established himself. So I love that. And I would expect nothing less than you come on the show and we lead with the Detroit Pistons. Nothing less than that.
Hey, look, when you have 18 dunks in three games, like that's a lot of dunks, and they are 2-1. They beat the Bulls over the weekend. They blew the doors off the Bulls, and they're kind of, it's going to be interesting when Bogdanovich comes back, how they sort this all out. Because they seem to be all in on the beef stew, Jalen Duren starting front court. The spacing is very good, but like defensively, it's been okay. And yeah, it's Monty Williams 2-1. We'll see what happens.
It's what but he it's does.
It has brought me joy.
There we go. Which is all we can ask about, or all we can ask for, rather. So something that brings you joy. But now we're going
to
pivot.
Wait, you don't have to answer your own questions?
I mean, it's my show. I don't have to do whatever. I don't feel like it. But if you'd like me to, I can.
No, you proceed how you see fit.
All right. Well, how about this? Let's go with, if we're still going to stay with Detroit, we'll go with what Asar Thompson has looked like, because I sort of interjected as you were talking. That dude, yeah, the offensive game has a long way to go, but holy hell, is he everywhere on the other side of the other parts of the court. 11 rebounds a game, just under 5 assists a game, 2.5 or almost 2.5 blocks a game. He's just, the athleticism plays, he is backing down from absolutely nobody on the defensive end of the court. Whatever questions attended the Thompson twins coming out of Overtime Elite, you know, what would the translation be? How would it look? Physically, they absolutely are, you know, day one look the part. And the willingness to, as you know, you mentioned sort of the winning plays, the things that translate to, winning the possession battle, actually building something meaningful, the unglamorous stuff about being an NBA player, he has that stuff day one, and that is an exciting building block to have. Again, there's a lot of crowding in the guard rotation, in the front court, on the wings. There's a lot still to be sorted out in Detroit, but seeing somebody who right away has like the frame, the strength, the positional willingness to defend up and down, like he brings a ton of that right off the bat. So if you're saying like what we get out of our high lottery pick, you know, obviously what you're looking for is the Cade Cunningham version, he's going to be the singular offensive force, the guy that organizes everything for us. But if you got one of those and that looks like it's going to be there, you need the things around it. And Asar Thompson seems like he brings a ton of it. So let's stick with Detroit. Pistons fans, don't ever say we don't love you here on Divine Intervention. We begin the week with that before we move into, Zach, things scary that make times. Us a little bit afraid.
Scary bit. Hours.
Scary
hours.
Oh my God. Well, now I'm flashing immediately on every Nets tweet, all of the Harden Nets tweets. And I think that is a fear that I think we can put in our past. Now we can move past that. But so in the spirit of the season and in the spirit of talking about things about, you know, different NBA teams that scare us, I got to ask you, Zach Lowe, what is something that scares you?
I could go heavy on this. God only knows there's a lot of heavy places to go with this, but I just don't want to go. We all know what some
Thank
of the big
much.
Fears of the world are. It's fine. Like I could be the serious guy and do that, but I'm not going to do that. So it's Halloween week. And as I say on my podcast often, I am now a loser suburban dad. So one of the things that happens in the loser suburbs is that people really go all out decorating their houses and their lawns. And I respect that. We're like a medium tier Halloween household. We got some stuff, but we're not like the, oh my God, I have to gawk at this person's yard people.
Right.
about 10 houses down from me. I don't even know who these people are. Some family lives there. They have one thing in their front yard. One. And it is like a 12-foot tall werewolf with a torn shirt and torn pants, as if it has just transformed into a werewolf and torn up its clothes because it's now twice the size of the human that is in there somewhere. And they position it. So like most people position these things, they're right in front of their houses. They're like very clearly just right in your face decorations. They position this thing so that it's kind of creeping out of the side of their house, like in their side yard. So you actually kind of don't see it coming. And it's like an animatronic thing that every X amount of minutes roaring and growling at you. So I was walking back. I was walking back from a neighborhood dad loser Halloween party. Actually, not dads. also, women were also there. Just not dads. At late at night this past weekend, and the party house in my house in between is the werewolf house, and it's dark. Had a couple drinks, walking back to my house, and I hadn't realized that the werewolf was even up yet. And all of a sudden, I actually was legitimately frightened, because then you look over and it's making a frightening sound, and it looks like a monster is coming out of the backyard of this house. So I'm going to go with, I don't know who this family is, more power to them. They have the only actual thing that has scared me on Halloween, the big werewolf.
I love that for two reasons. One, it's a great way to learn more about your neighbors, to be like, so, hey, you know, we passed by this the other night. You literally scared the daylights out of me. And so I need to introduce myself. Hi, I'm Zach. That frightens me. And
also, Dan, you're not a suburban loser dad. One thing about the suburbs is
loser dad, but still in the boroughs. Yes.
So one thing about the suburbs is, depending on your street and the lighting quality, it's very, very dark at night. Like the city does not get pitch dark at night. Right. It's like pitch ass dark here when this werewolf started screaming at me and howling. And I was unnerved.
That was going to be my answer to the question. So my wife grew up in Westchester. When we go up and visit with her family, it is like the house is like behind a little like lake, and there's no lighting like anywhere. So yeah, every time whether it's like we're driving up there or I have to go run to the car for something at night, I imagine like, this is basically like being in Cabin in the Woods or being in one of these slasher movies. Like and I don't know why I think that, because I know intellectually this person that I love and married grew up here and she survived. And so, but then I also have a lot more respect for her ability to survive those things than I have for my own. Like I imagine myself in the Walking Dead kind of universe that I'd be one of the early episode departures, you know, like she'd have a rich story that goes on for many years. I would be like the thing that she had to slough off in order to become her true self there. But maybe that's a little bit of a heavy thing for me to bring up in this context, Zach. I don't know. Yeah, we're just having a conversation.
That went a direction I didn't expect there,
but also a werewolf is good. I mean, these are all things that frighten me. So that's fine.
The big werewolf is just an A+ Halloween decoration. Kudos to anonymous suburban neighbors that I don't know.
We're also going to have to put a pin in it. The big werewolf is a nickname that's going to have to go to somebody. We're going to have to figure out who the big werewolf is, but you know, we don't have to do that right now.
Jonas Valanciunas just came to my mind as the first guy.
I love that. And we're going to put that on the whiteboard. We're going to see if we can't beat that later, but I love that as a starting place. Because also any mention of, I think that is probably the first Jonas Valanciunas mentioned. We're only two episodes in. I don't think Concepcion brought him up last week. So you're on the board, which I love. I also love that you did your homework, Zach. You know, I'm a homework kid. We talk about this. I know that you are a teacher. You respect the craft of doing the work. And we're going to talk today about three things, NBA things that scare you. So it was a broad concept, could be something very specific, could be something very general. But we're going to go back and forth, kind of stagger our lists and talk back and forth. I'd like to hear, what is your first thing that scares you so far this season?
So I was much lower than consensus on the Memphis Grizzlies. All the win projection systems that spit them out number one or number two in the West before the Steven Adams injury, I looked askance at those, and I was like, I don't like to go dramatically against the machine. Part of it is because there had been rumblings about Steven Adams not being right all summer. And so I kind of wondered, at least in my head, like, is he actually healthy even when he was playing in the preseason? Turns out he was not. Everyone talks about how deep the Grizzlies are. And I look at them and I'm like, I think people are mistaking this Grizzlies team for the one that had Brandon Clark and Steven Adams and Tyus Jones and John Morant and some other proven players. And like the bench of this team is kind of a bunch of unknown dudes with Morant out and you know, somebody currently Zaire Williams promoted into the starting five. And Zaire Williams himself is kind of an unproven dude. And so far, those fears have been borne out even worse than I had expected. They just look bad. And there's just a lot of Desmond Bane being forced to do everything all the time. And Jaren Jackson Jr.'s offense really needs someone who can bend the defense for him in a way that John Morant can and no one else on the team really can. And there's just a lot of like, all right, what does David Roddy have? All right, yeah. Jake LaRivia, you're up. Okay, Kenneth Lofton Jr., I guess we got to try you, big fella. And just like a lot of, you know, their next three or four games aren't that hard. They have Portland twice in the next 8-9 days. But, you know, they just, it was reported last night they're going to sign Biombo maybe. It doesn't surprise me, having watched their first three games, that there is a semi-panic signing already maybe in the works. So that's thing number one.
Yeah, I mean, because it even extends beyond that. I'd take, you know, been looking at their offense, because what we expect from their offense, or what the identity that they've crafted, is, you know, downhill driving, it's offensive rebounding, and it's transition, right? That's who they've been in this iteration as they've grown up. And obviously Ja, losing him takes away so much of that downhill driving. Losing Adams and Clark takes away so much of that offensive rebounding. And then it's, well, if you're like running the court with Bane at the top of the, or with the ball in his hands, or Marcus Smart with the ball in his hands, like, you're not, that's not like a fast paced team. And so you're taking out table legs, and it's like, well, what's left over there? You're absolutely right. It's Desmond Bane having to increase his volume, his touches per game, his usage, all of those things are way up. And he's doing that against, it's not, you're getting the second or third guy every night. You're getting Herb Jones, you're getting Denny Avdia, you're getting, you know, KCP when you play the Nuggets. Like, you're dealing with the number one perimeter defender. And then who's making life easier for you? And right now, I mean, Jaren Jackson Jr. is taking 11 shots a game because, as you said, he's the one that needs things to be made a little bit easier for him to create. So Biombo, I was thinking about that. I mean, primarily as just, we need another five to put next to Jaren to sort of organize the structure of the team. But maybe also, I mean, he is a screen, you know, stick somebody with a screen and dive. And so maybe there's like an organizing principle to some of those minutes that helps clarify things a little bit. But yeah, you know, there's a lot of like jack of all trades, master of none kind of thing with all of those wing options. And then Luke Kennard goes out and you're like suddenly playing more guys that defenses don't have to respect. An already shaky half court offense gets even more constricted, more tight. Like when we talked about the Grizzlies before the season, I was like, well, what are they after 25 games? Are they, you know, are they 10-15? Are they, you know, where are they? And if this is what the offense is going to look like, it could be a lot south of that by the time Ja even gets back. So, yeah, I think it is a reasonable fear to throw out there for sure.
Okay. I like it. We agree on my first fear.
I'm going to go. We spoke with Victor. Not spoke with Victor. That would be a pretty big feat for this show. We spoke about Victor early in the show. My fear is that the Spurs giganto ball lineup is not going to pan out. It's not going to work. Everybody wrote a million things about Victor and talked about Victor, what Wembanyama was going to bring. One of the things that I was most curious about was, like, how weird is Pop going to get lineup-wise? What kind of team do you want to construct around him? And in one of those columns I wrote, I was like, well, maybe they'll just try to. Sohan brought the ball up a ton last year. He was a guy that initiated offense. Maybe they try that. And then they go with that in the preseason. And I'm like, all right, let's get weird. Everybody's like 6'5" and over. Everybody handles the ball. Everybody creates. And then through the first three games, they've been outscored by 43 points. And that's with Trey Jones being plus 15. The worst plus minus on the team is Sohan at minus 48. And that doesn't feel coincidental. That starting lineup, and obviously with the broader caveat of this is all small samples, it's only a few games, yada, yada, yada. They're scoring 75 points per 100 possessions with that starting lineup on the floor. There just isn't enough shooting and collective playmaking in that group yet. And maybe that's a like long-term play. The defense has looked, I mean, before they got absolutely smoked by the Clippers on Sunday night, the defense had looked pretty good with that. I mean, as you'd expect with all that size, all that length, and some like legitimate plus defenders on that starting lineup. But this is, if this is going to work, every member of that starting five is going to have to take a step forward as a playmaker. And I think it's just, it's a lot to ask early in the development cycles of some of those guys. And it doesn't seem like we're going to walk away from that anytime soon. Jeff McDonald at the Express News mentioned last night that before the game, Pop had called Sohan at that point guard, like, quote, our official 2023-2024 experiment. So like, they're committed to it. They're going to give it runway. It just might be, they might sputter and cough an awful lot on that runway when it comes time to try to score some points.
Well, you can continue the experiment and play it 12 minutes a game, 10 right. minutes a game instead of starting it. But yeah, I mean, this will be in my column on Friday, most likely my first like roundup column of the year. I did watch their Clippers game last night. Their defense was bad. And if the defense is not going to be like outstanding, the juice is not going to be worth the squeeze with that lineup. And it wasn't last night. There's just a lot of Zach Collins doing stuff. And I like Zach Collins. I've always liked Zach Collins, but there's just a lot of Zach Collins, and there's no shooting really at all other than Vassell. I mean, Wembanyama is probably an okay shooter right now for his size. He's a completely unprecedented shooter, obviously, but they're trying to figure out how to use him and actions to get him going. But I also don't, if this season doesn't really result in too many wins, I don't think the Spurs are going to be super upset about that. Let's like the upside is one more crack at the top of the lottery before Wembanyama makes you too good to ever be there again, which is something we see with every generational prospect that comes in. We saw with LeBron in Cleveland. Okay, well, the Cavs never have a high draft pick again because LeBron is just too good. Right. Yeah, but that lineup has not looked very good.
It's also worth remembering that experiments often explode, right? Like that's, you know, it's the scientific method at work. Like you try something, it flames out spectacularly. You tweak some things, you try again. It's just, you know, this one has not borne fruit in quite the ways they were hoping for. But all right, that's one for me. What's number two for you, Zachary?
It's early. I believe they've only played two games so far, so I don't want to get too carried away. And they won one of them, and they actually won the one I saw start to finish. Cat and Gobert still look bad together in Minnesota. Mm. And it's early. I get it. It's fine. Like, I'm not too worried about it, but the offense has been bad. The defense has been not good. I don't worry too much about the defense. I think their defense will be fine once McDaniels comes back. It still just looks clunky and out of sync. And like, they don't really know quite what to do with Cat when Gobert is on the floor as the main screen setter. And it's just something we've all been monitoring. We didn't get a ton of it last year because Cat was ill in training camp and then missed most of the season with injury. And then, you know, they had a very short playoff run where they actually looked all right. So we've all been kind of looking forward, like year two, we got a full training camp, you know, everyone's ready to go. Team is mostly healthy until McDaniels goes out. Early returns are like, it's a little bit clunky and a little bit ugly. So I'm the alarm bell isn't going off, but my attention to detail and my curiosity for Minnesota early in the season is even greater than it was a week ago, in part because I was pretty high on this team. And even while being pretty high on this team, was well aware that they really need to get off to a good start or else some of these issues are going to go from the background to the foreground real fast.
Two things on the Wolves there. One, I think everybody respects the heck out of Chris Finch as an offensive coach, somebody that is very creative and has a lot of ideas for how to make things work. But a lot of the lifting on like, well, he's going to figure this out. He's figured out two big offenses before and it's worked out great. It's like, well, one, you know, there was Jokic and I mean, I love Kat, but Jokic is a different breed than that. And then there was also the one that was in New Orleans was AD and DeMarcus Cousins. And it's like, where's the Rudy Gobert analog in that offensive dynamic, right? Where it's like the amount of offensive juice of driving, of playmaking, shooting, all of that sort of stuff is just different when you've got two guys that can do all of that versus one guy. And then one guy you're trying to continually figure out the geometry around. So I think that's like, maybe there's been an assumption of solution based on past experience that doesn't necessarily track for this dynamic. And then the second thing, I think you're absolutely right to note the need to get off to a good start, because the one version of the Wolves that really clicked last year was the one that wasn't built around those two guys. It was the one that was built around Ant as the number one option. It's what made Ant and all, you know, Ant got to the All-Star game because he was doing everything when Cat was out and needed to be that number one option. And so if you've got kind of like a use case or a proof of concept for what does work, and you're like, yeah, but we have to make this other thing work, and it's not, I can imagine that leads to some tensions and maybe a collective raising of blood pressure in Minnesota, which, you know, maybe doesn't need that.
And the Cousins-Davis front court was never really stress tested in New Orleans. They didn't play that much together. They didn't play in the playoffs at all together. We don't really know how that would have worked over a long sample size, both on offense and defense, because defense is part of the equation too, as much as we're going to focus on offense looking at the Cat-Gobert fit. But yeah, that's I still like the fake trade that I've been talking about for 2 years, where Minnesota and Atlanta just look at each other with sad faces. Like, you know what? Your thing's not working. My thing's not working. Let's trade your thing for my thing. We'll take Trey. You take Cat. It's kind of a challenge trade. It's kind of like a sad face challenge trade. Whatever. Like, I still kind of like that one. But both of those teams, they are my... It's not quite make or break, but I do think the constructions of their respective rosters in some big way maybe on the line this season. Like, the Hawks can only float around as this like 40 win whatever team for so long before something happens. And they blew out the Bucks last night in a really strange game in which they looked good and the Bucks looked horrible. So we'll see. You know, I was high on the Hawks before the season. I could be wrong on them too.
Hey, you were famously high on the Hawks, I believe. I believe there's a fairly rich bet placed on that between you and our friend Tim Bontemps.
Yeah, who was sitting next to me at the Knicks-Celtics game last week and tapped me on the shoulder to show me the Hornets-Hawks score from opening night. And I said, it's one game, f***o, or something like that. And just...
We should all, well, first off, we're going to have to bleep that, but we should all be calling Tim Bontemps that. I think that we're pretty safe there. As you bring up your interaction with Tim at Knicks-Celtics, that brings me to my second fear here. In the spirit of you saying with the Wolves, you're not like, it's not alarm bells yet. Knicks offense, it still doesn't feel real that they were like a top three offense last year.
It didn't make sense at all.
Yeah.
It still doesn't make sense.
And
I didn't know you could be that good at offense without being able to shoot at all. It just doesn't make any sense.
Right. It turns out just like Jalen Brunson just chiseling his way into layups, and just like the sheer volume of Julius Randle and RJ Barrett can get you places. But yeah, the Knicks through the first, they're, you know, 1-2, the offenses look pretty sluggish and scattershot. They're terrible in the paint so far. Randle and Brunson are a combined 13 for 43 in the paint through three games. Randle's 1 for 12 at the rim, which is pretty hard when you're as big and as strong as he is. Maybe some of that, you know, I don't want to say that it's Skechers based. I don't know. It's hard to tell. We'll have to, you know, we'll need more of a sample size for that. But it's just like a team-wide shooting slump, which is, you know, the case for optimism, which is that everybody not named RJ Barrett won't shoot 40% from the floor for the rest of the season. But the recipe that made them a mystery top offense last year was pound the offensive glass, don't turn the ball over, get to the line a bunch, and when your second unit gets in, play and transition a ton. And so far, like, they're hitting the offensive glass, but if you turn the ball over a little more, you get to the line a little less, you miss your free throws, and you're not making it up with the bench units that are just blitzing everybody, it's just not going to be enough to scratch out points against good defenses, which, that's the other sort of caveat here, is you saw them on opening night against what might wind up being a top, you know, five defense in the league with that meat grinder unit the Celtics can throw out there. And then it's, you know, three games and four nights to open the season, a back-to-back on the road. Maybe some of this normalizes, but they were, it already felt like a house of cards a little bit, this Knicks offense. And if everything that went right last year doesn't go right again, you worry a little bit that it starts to tumble down.
Well, their next five games are Cleveland, Milwaukee, Clippers, Spurs. Cleveland has not had Jared Allen yet, but, you know, Evan Mobley is a deterrent at the rim that the Knicks are familiar with. They obviously rolled the Cavs in the playoffs, but that was mostly because the Cavs could not score. Milwaukee has Giannis and Brooke Lopez. The Clippers are not a huge size team, although Zubats is underrated, and the Spurs are obviously gigantic up front, which is my way of saying, like, this is an interesting stretch where the just throw yourself into larger guys with long arms strategy which is when the Knicks look their ugliest, when it's just Randall throwing himself at Kristaps Porzingis over and over again and getting turned away. That may not be a great successful strategy in these next five games. So let's see if it works or if they can adapt somehow, because I do think as good as the Knicks were last year and as well as they played in the first round of the playoffs, they're not going to win big, like conference finals level big. And that may be a heady ambition in any way at this point, but they just need to have a more creative, adaptable offense than they have. You're only going to get so far as like team battering ram. And I think their offense will stabilize. They're obviously shooting horribly on twos, and this is a good team, but I think the model has to be a little more adaptable for long-term postseason success.
Yeah, and maybe they can get to some of that just because there's more shooting on this team. There's more, you know, guards who can do something with the ball. There's a little more versatility than last year's model. You know, if you ratchet up the minutes for Grimes, ratchet up the minutes for Quickly, DiVincenzo continues to, provide a little bit of everything. Like there's maybe more arrows in the quiver there, but the dark voice in the head, the negative guy is like, this is also year five Tibbs, and every Tibbs team winds up with this same kind of critique. Like, you just wish they had a little bit more of an idea offensively, and it happens with all of them. And then eventually when it flames out spectacularly. And this is the part where I also have to remember that before that road trip last year, where they were like, we're going to pocket Fournier, it was like, is Tibbs about to be fired? Like that was, they were the turnaround was so dramatic that you forget where they were through that first month of the season. And with the schedule that you just mentioned, the start that they've had, things can get dicey quickly if things don't normalize quicker than that.
Let's be honest. This is really about Randall as much as Tibbs, and maybe more than Tibbs, because when they have Hart or Quickly on the floor, all of a sudden there's at least a pace to how they play that Barrett can adapt to. Barrett is a pretty active open floor player, and is probably at his best when things are moving a little bit faster and it's not just team battering ram. And Julius just has not really kind of fit into that ethos as cleanly as you would like. And sometimes just kind of wants to play Julius ball. And, you know, he's had a fantastic 2 years out of three with the Knicks and got his kudos and got his all NBA stuff and all deserved. He's been outstanding. You would just like a little more maybe internal recognition that, all right, if it's just me like going into Clint Capela over and over again, or Bam Adebayo over and over again, or pick your guy like Giannis over and over again, like I'm kind of not that dude. Like I'm a dude, I'm pretty good at a lot of things, but I'm not that dude.
A dude versus that dude is really the level debate, right? That's the thing, you know, two out of the last three all NBA teams, but how much do people believe it? Is that which is a pretty big fear for a lot of Knicks fans. Let's move past that.
By the way, move past that quite yet.
Okay.
Game one at Madison Square Garden, there was already some murmuring bordering on boos for Randall, on some of those shots. Like the love-hate relationship is still very much a thing. And like even when they introduced him to the starting five, it was not like a rousing universal level of adulation. It's the fans are I'm not going to say ready to turn on him, but they do not seem to really enjoy the Julius Randle experience when it's not just rolling completely.
There's a lot of, we're talking about fears today. I think there's a lot of fear that what you have seen, like the flip side of fear is hope. And the hope is that a guy who has been as productive and as useful a player for most of his career in New York can get over the hump, that you're seeing like the hero's journey kind of thing of bit by bit by bit. And then he's able to get over the hump. And I think the fear is that what you have seen with your own eyes is what it is. And that the evidence that you've seen in the playoffs where it's, you know, under 40% from the floor and, you know, yada, 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 more assists than turnovers, I believe, in his postseason runs in New York, that you've seen the reality and that it's not going to get better than that. And so I think Knicks fans, well, a famously tetchy bunch to begin with, but also like there's been enough evidence to say like, as soon as you start to see it, you're not going to will it into something better, which is a bummer because one of the great defining characteristics of an MSG crowd is like, it does feel sometimes like the ability to will something positive into happening in spite of decades of evidence that you can't. But, you know, hope is a beautiful thing to have. Just maybe a little bit tenuous to grasp onto it. What it's not tenuous to grasp onto, Zach, is your third thing that scares you.
This is more of an emotional thing than an analytical thing.
That's what this show is about.
I wish there had been more apparent progress on extension talks between Klay Thompson and the Warriors, because I want Klay Thompson, Steph Curry, and Draymond Green to play together until the wheels completely fall off and then all three retire at the same time. I don't want to see, I understand there's financial realities and Draymond signed a deal that I think is pretty fair from a team perspective, given his age, and maybe Klay looked at that deal like, wow, that's lower than I expected. And obviously Klay had an up and down season last year that ended down. He's off to an start this season, and we'll leave the basketball part of it. Like let's see how the season goes for Klay. But it's hard not to romanticize the way those three fit together and what they have experienced together and what they've built together. And it wouldn't be some just like, it's not like seeing, you know, what's your classic, just Jordan Wizards. It's not like that, right? Like where seeing him in another uniform would just be this thing that we all repel against and don't want to ever see again. Like, you know, Joe Namath on didn't Joe Namath go to the Rams or something?
There's right.
Something like one of those kind of things. But it's more that trio fits so perfectly together. It's like, it's everything you want in basketball, everything you aspire to build as a team and to see as a fan and to experience as a player is encapsulated in those three guys. And so I just don't want to see them break up. And so we're here, the season started. All the reports have been like super far apart, nothing really going on. I just want a little more optimism. That's all.
I think that's a great one. Setting aside, I mean, the financial component of it, I can't blame Klay Thompson for saying like, yes, everybody acknowledges that this is the house that Steph built and that, you know, Draymond is a generational defender whose elevation unlocked everything for us. But, you know, Klay Thompson is no doubt about it, Hall of Famer, who has been there every step of that way too. And like, if he feels like, I should also be taken care of in perpetuity for what I have been to this organization, what I have been to this market, to this city, to whatever. I can't blame him for that at all. I would absolutely understand that. I would absolutely respect and understand fans thinking that as well. I'm a soft touch on that stuff because my version of the thing you're talking about, the thing that that repels me, that I get revolted by, is Ewing in the on the Magic or on the Sonics. Like those jerseys where I'm like, yes, I understand. One. He was like at the age and post the injury and everything else, but you need to recognize your Saints. You need to acknowledge and appreciate those who carried the banner for that long. Now that's for me, like not somebody who didn't deliver a championship, but let alone, you know, four, but I have a hard time with it sometimes. Something like, say, Kyle Lowry, right? Or Van Vliet, right? Examples of guys where, and Lowry is a bigger one because he had been there for longer and had been through the stations of the cross with those Raptors teams for so much longer. And I understood people saying, like, you have to move that guy for something of value before he hits free agency, because otherwise you're wasting the asset. But there's also something ineffable that you gain. Like, we're not just going to give that guy away. That guy has meant too much to us for so long. And I think I understand the cold analytical component of, right, but that is a missed opportunity in a roster management sense. Yeah, but there's something to be gained by getting to say goodbye to that guy the right way too. And, you know, like not just saying in February before everybody's really ready for it, he goes. Like that, when you have a player that meant so much to you, it's when in the Dirk years where it was like, I mean, how long is Dirk going to stick around here? You know, is Dallas going to look to move him? Is he going to look for his way out or whatever? When you've got a guy that means that much to you, or that has meant that much to the organization, I think, you know, you let that guy decide when to go, and you do everything you can to make it worth his while to stay. I'm with you on that.
It's interesting because you mentioned the Raptors, who obviously famously traded a beloved homegrown player for Kawhi Leonard, and that worked out well. They had emotional attachment to DeMar DeRozan. And the other thing I was going to say is, you know, there's as wonderful as Kyle Lowry is, and I have been on team Kyle Lowry is awesome for a long time. He will make the Hall of Fame. He is arguably probably the greatest Raptor ever. You know, there's a difference between a one-time NBA champion and a who was not drafted by your team. I mean, he's not a homegrown Raptor. He played elsewhere, Houston and Memphis before Toronto. And there's a difference between that guy and four-time champion, 11 threes in game six, coming out to make free throws in the finals on a busted knee, Klay Thompson. And those are four championships is immortal kind of stuff. But on the flip side, Andre Iguodala was there, not quite from the start, but not homegrown, not a lifetime warrior, but there for the dynasty. And they, in what was a painful and emotional trade for them, dealt him away along with the first round pick and to trigger the series of transactions that allowed them to kind of pivot and get Wiggins and all of that. And like, there is a cost to your emotional attachment. There is a cost to not doing things, an opportunity cost. It's interesting, but Klay is Klay, man. And Klay, those three should play together. You know, again, Andre came midway through the building process and was kind of the final piece. Klay, Steph, Draymond is the foundation, and you just want to see it stay.
Absolutely. And we'll move off of this at the risk of invoking something that our mutual former boss aligned from a movie that he loved. Yeah, you can't lose what you don't put in the middle, but you can't win much either. And there is a cost to what you sacrifice by not, you know, moving on from with your emotions, by clinging to those things. But that's also, it's what we're all here for, right? Like, and so from a fan perspective, which I know that's tricky to navigate as we do the work that we do. And you and I are sort of different, occupy different areas in terms of you are much more of a reporter than I am. But the idea of when you sacrifice that and you say like everything has to be about what allows us to be competitive 2, 3, 4 years down the line, you lose something there too, or you can lose something with that. And the experience, like, the casuals are what keep the lights on too. So that kind of emotional component, I think, is something that shouldn't be too far from our thoughts. I was going to do my final one was going to be like the Rockets whole deal, but also like the Rockets, like, them being bad would not be a particularly large surprise. Them being bad in the way that they've been so far has not been great. But, you know, I think the part where like the opponents are shooting 75% against Şengün at the rim, and the only reason I was really going to do this was to make a joke for my friend Roger Sherman, formerly of the Ringer. Jalen Green is 17 of 38 on two-pointers. Roger would call that a Fetty Wap, 17-38. So, Roger, if you're listening there, that one's for you. I'm going to go with something that should be scary to the rest of the league, which is the possibility that the Nuggets are just getting started. This has not been a surprise that they have hit the ground running to this degree, but holy hell, have they hit the ground running? They're scoring about 124 points per 100 possessions with Jokic on the floor. He is basically like a lion that sort of stretches and yawns his way into triple doubles. He is dealing with challenges like a stretch five Chet Holmgren, picking his teeth with him and then saying like he needs to get a little fatter, which is, I think, fair and accurate, but also a funny thing to hear Jokic say as a scouting report. Jamal Murray looks like he's on a get me to my first all-star team kind of start. The rest of that starting five is fantastic. They closed out the Lakers on opening night. They're getting good minutes out of that second unit. You know, Peyton Watson showing why a lot of people were excited about him. Reggie Jackson looking like, oh, remember, I can actually be a point guard in this league. Like, I'm a backup point guard and a good one. It just feels like if the offense is the offense, and with that starting five, it's going to be, and the defense can be malleable with that second unit, Zeke Nagy at the five, they're going to be able to switch more, all that kind of stuff. They are a team that you're not going to have a whole hell of a lot of answers for. And the possibility that what we saw in June was not the apex of something, but maybe like the, you know, a plateau that they can remain at, I think ought to be terrifying to an awful lot of teams around the league.
I didn't know we could do that. That we could say this is something the league should fear as one of our fears. I thought it had to be something that I was scared about.
Well, Zach, here's the thing. The fear you should have is that you don't know all the rules of the show you're going on.
Yeah. Because I thought about that. I thought not necessarily okay. With the Nuggets. I thought about...
Give me one you were thinking about.
No, I don't even remember anymore. But I got nothing to add on the Nuggets other than I said during the finals, Jamal Murray will make the All-Star team next year this year. He's just a lock. Lock him in. The coaches are going to put him on. And the big fella's that good. Like, the championship goes through Denver as long as he's healthy and the starting five is healthy, but particularly Jokic. Like, he's that good. There's no answer for him. You can be fat. You can be skinny. You can be tall. You can be short. You can be quick. You could have quick hands, you could have slow hands and quick feet. Whatever you do, you don't have an answer for him individually. So not surprising given their level of continuity at the starting five, and not surprising given their optimism about Peyton Watson and Christian Brown that their bench has held their own. I still think, you know, that will be stress tested down the line against better teams, but the big fella is that good. And Jamal Murray's two-man game with him is that good, but it's really just he is that good. And he's an all-time great player who's in his prime and is just kind of like solved offensive basketball. Like there's just he's solved it. Like there's just nothing you can do really.
We move from the Nuggets starting five to something we are going to call the closing five. Five questions from my guest, Zach.
I forgot about this.
Because as I'm sure you are aware, Zach Lowe, you're a certified ball knower. Whether you start and how you start is not as important as whether and how you finish the game. That's where the money's made. Question number one, Zach, what was your first basketball love?
Probably we had a hoop in the backyard and I would play with my dad when I was a little kid. And probably first basketball love was trying to imitate Kevin McHale's up and under in the backyard as a kid. That was my favorite move. Kevin McHale was my favorite player to watch as a little kid, and didn't really work against my dad, who gave me no quarter in those games.
This, I mean, as is the father's want, that is what you need to do.
You know what? I should say he let, particularly when we would play like, he would play one on two against a couple of my friends. He would let us foul him indiscriminately. But the up and under, he was not like fake biting on the pump fake just so that I could get the up and under.
Yeah. You got to stay down on the fakes. It's an important lesson to learn. Question number two, we go from fathers and sons to fathers and daughters. You have a young daughter. How often do you watch basketball with her?
Not very often. I don't start watching games until she's in bed generally. Right. We did attend a WNBA game together recently and then watched some of the WNBA finals because she got into it. And of course, like immediately considers herself an expert having attended one game. Like when I showed her highlights of game four when the Aces won the title and we were watching the final possession in which Stewie gets double teamed and they swing it to Vandersloot in the corner. She's like, Daddy, you know, Sloot's not that great of a shooter. Like, that was pretty smart defense. I'm like, okay, so settle down, kid.
It's incredible, though, that she's like, I'm already downloading the important parts of the defense, what you got to do for that. Yeah, that line of the dividing line of like, this is the thing I do for work, which you as my child will find uninteresting. And this is the thing that I love. So you'll be drawn to that. Like, that's a push and pull. My kid's much the same way.
She is getting old enough now. She's eight and change that I think we're going to take her to a couple NBA games. We're going to do a couple family NBA games this year, which we have not done. Cause you know, you just like, if it's a school night, it's a late
yes,
night.
And, absolutely.
I'm a big school night guy. It's a school night. It's like school night. Can't do anything. It's a school night. But I think we'll sacrifice a couple school nights.
Question number three, building off of school nights. Do you remember your high school yearbook quote? And if so, what was it?
It was horrible, actually.
Bring it on.
Something like, oh God, what was it? I want to Google it because I want to get it right.
I
you know what?
That.
I'm not even going to Google it. It's so bad that I'm not going to. It was something about, I don't even remember who said it. Somebody famous said it. Something about how if you stay on the right track, you'll just get run over or something like that. Something that's supposed to inspire you to continue self-growth. Like if you just stay on the right track, eventually the train will run you over, something to that effect. And then I had this stupid thing where everyone lists their initials of their friends because, yes, you know, that's something you really care about. Actually, I don't even know where my yearbook is. Do you know where your yearbook is?
Somewhere in my mom's house in Staten Island. But super producer John Gennaro finds me an image here that says, from the quote is, even if you're on the right track, you'll get run over if you just sit there. Will
that's
Rogers.
It. That's it.
This is great why quote. you need super producers with you.
And I have shouted out before Ned Lanneman, who I was not friends with in high school and have certainly not talked to since high school and have not seen since high school. He was the winner of best yearbook quote. Well, there were two. One was Ned Lanneman, whose yearbook quote was, it was one line, no initials, no anything, just one line, no nonsense. Never play leapfrog with a unicorn. And then my friend Jason Brown, also one line, no initials, no nonsense. I will become something like, I will become immortal, not through my work and my deeds, but by simply not dying. And I was like, that it starts out as like, it sounds like this is going to be an inspirational quote and then takes her. I like those. Those are my two from my high school class that really hit it out of the park.
I'm really glad we could get most a shout out to Ned like, Lanaman.
First loves are forever, blah, blah, blah. Miss yeah. you girls, blah, zip codes and stupid clubs like blah, 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 blah.
Okay. No, high shouts school out sucked. To
high school sucked,
to,
by the way.
Shouts out to Ned Lanaman and is it Jason Brown?
Shock, it's Jason Brown. Shocker. Yeah. Zach Lowe did not have a great time in high school. Shocking plot twist.
All right. Let's have a good time now. Question four. What was the last live performance you went to? Music, theater, comedy, whatever.
Oh, God, this is just going to be. I mean, if you want me to answer the question, honestly.
Of course I do. I don't want you to lie to me.
Well, it's embarrassing. No, it's not embarrassing. It's just like if you could. I saw it was totally entertaining. I saw with a bunch of friends, David Sedaris recently did a live reading.
What's embarrassing about that? That guy's hilarious.
Near where we live, and a bunch of us, it was a few, like 3 or 4 weeks ago before the season started, a bunch of us went out to dinner, got some babysitters, had a couple drinks, and listened to David Sedaris read comedy essays for an hour and a half.
Well, you're
just, it's not like you want to have an answer that's like, hey, this underground band did this concert and I went and saw it because I got into this and like, blah, blah, blah. And it's no, it's just the nerds did like a nerd thing together. And like, that was it.
You don't have to apologize for enjoying one of the funnier people that the country has turned out in the last 50 years. It's okay. You're allowed to do that. And I think you say you want something underground and whatever. I mean, this is not like you're saying I went to go see Dave Matthews at the Giant Stadium. Like you, this is an underground thing. It's just a different style of one. You should feel good about that and feel good about yourself. Question number five. You've been for a long time, someone whose work people read to help them understand the game better, myself included. I'm wondering who are some of those people for you? You know, this is Divine Intervention is, if nothing else, a recommendation engine and a source of positivity in our space. Who are people where you read their stuff and you're like, damn, I wish I thought of that.
Well, rest in peace. Jonathan Sharks was always one.
Amen.
I miss reading him a lot. You have guys you read for cap stuff and trade angles, and Hollinger has always been the gold standard sure. for that for me for years and years and years. I've always said that John Hollinger and Rob Nyer, as when I was a big baseball fan, were kind of just, particularly reading Rob Nyer in college because I was younger, was sort of like, oh, I didn't know you could do this and right. be like, and be writing at a place like ESPN. There's good tactical writers all over the place covering NBA teams. There's one guy who writes for The Score, based in Toronto, Joel Wolfend. I may be pronouncing his name incorrectly. Wolfond, I think.
That's right.
Who is very much Charksy in his precision and analytical way of thinking about team building. I read everything he writes, and usually I'm like, huh, that's pretty damn good. That's a good idea. That's a good adjustment. I'm sure there are people I'm forgetting coaching wise, but those are some good names to shine on.
Absolutely fantastic. And we move from the recommendation engine of people to read to we end with every show with a weekly recommendation. Could be about anything. Doesn't have to be about basketball. Jason Concepcion last week recommended the histories of Herodotus. So the field is open,
Oh,
Zach.
Okay, Jason. Wow, great. Game of Thrones guy gets all highbrow on us with this. Okay,
I mean,
put
he's
a little
maester.
Pressure on me.
Yeah, what do you want from him? He's a maester. Well, it can be anything, Zach. So
well, I mean, Ovid's Metamorphoses I have not read in quite some time, and I really enjoy. I do enjoy a good Greek and Roman mythology. My friend, who's a writer, Kashmir Hill, who writes for the New York Times, just wrote a book called Your Face Belongs to Us about facial recognition and technology and artificial intelligence. And it has an NBA, shockingly, it has an NBA subplot involving your beloved New York Knicks and James Dolan.
Exactly. Right.
But also it's like, it's one of these classic. It's almost like a detective novel because the book is based on a company that essentially doesn't want you to know they exist and certainly didn't want a journalist to sure. know that they existed. And it's about her just literally trying to find where they are and who they are and do they have an office and where is their office and who the hell are these people and where is the money behind them and who and just – what are they doing? Oh my God, they're doing that and police are using it and the FBI is using it. And like, whoa, this is crazy. Your Face Belongs to Us. It's an awesome book with an NBA subplot. And every time I talk about technology, I'll give you a bonus recommendation. Have not talked with Kashmir Hill about this television show, but I am an evangelist. It's my second favorite show of all time. Not enough people watched it. Halt and Catch Fire. Mina Kimes and I have talked about doing a special Halt and Catch Fire podcast because some of the cast has agreed to do it with us and then we still haven't done it. Incredible show. As long as technology is on the brain, I always recommend that. So, too.
Zach, we're going to let you go right there because I know we're up against your heart out. I'll finish my outro and stuff after that. But, Zach, thank you so much for taking all this time with us today. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Have fun.
All right. Be good, man. For mine, I'm going to recommend Blank Check, a movie podcast hosted by a comedian named Griffin Newman and a film critic, David Sims of The Atlantic. Focuses on directors who get super successful early in their careers and then can kind of do whatever they want. And then it breaks down their filmographies. Right now, they're covering David Fincher, banger after banger after banger. They just did a 3-hour episode on The Social Network. And my only complaint is that it was not longer. So Blank Check podcast, wherever you get your podcast, check that out. Also, we know that you have enough time in your week for more than one NBA podcast. I have to imagine you are already subscribed to The Low Post with Zach Lowe. If you are not, I suggest that you get that right. Go take care of that as soon as you are done with this podcast, which you are right now. That's going to do it for episode 2 of Divine Intervention. Thank you to Zach Lowe for taking all this time to be with me and, let's be honest, to reconnect with himself. Thank you to super producer John Gennaro for doing all the things that he does to make this show look and sound great. If you've made it this far, subscribe to Ball Don't Lie on YouTube or whatever podcast platform you're currently listening on. Leave us a 5-star review. It helps us with discoverability and getting up those charts. Thank you so much for listening. We will see you again next week. Take care of yourself. You deserve it.